This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people. Hello and welcome to this episode of the MDT podcast. I am Jo Preston and I'm a geriatrician in London.
And I'm Ian Wilkinson. I'm a geriatrician in Surrey.
And with us today in the studio, we have two guest faculty who are going to introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Mary Newlocken, and I'm working as an academic clinical fellow in geriatric medicine in King's in London.
Hello, my name is Dr. Gabor CK, and I am a general practitioner with a special interest in elderly care.
And today we're going to talk through sexual activity and older adults, and we're going to have a little bit of a think around some of the changes associated with ageing and how that may affect people's sexual life.
At the end of this, we want you to realise how common it is for older adults to have active sex lives.
Yeah, and we want you to feel that you can approach these sort of conversations regarding sexuality with older people.
And to look at being able to assess sexual expression, particularly in the context of cognitive impairment.
Yeah. And to think about the fact that sexual needs and expression are a completely normal part of the life course, regardless of somebody's age.
And to really kind of think about looking at people's sexual needs as part of a holistic assessment.
But before we get to that, Jo, shall we have a think about stuff that we've seen on Twitter and social media this week?
Yeah.
Have you got something?
I do. So one of the things I saw that I wanted to share was the Geriatrics for Juniors conference, which is coming up again. I think it's in November. In Newcastle.
Super good.
Yeah, it's really cheap. It's for anybody who's working with older adults, for students, for juniors, also nurse practitioners. They're opening up to now as well. It's like 50 quid, it's a day, and they cover loads of really good topics.
Mary, have you been?
I have been three times, I think, and really enjoyed it. It's really, really good. I definitely recommend it to juniors, and always talking about it on at Young Jerry's on Twitter as well.
So Mary runs a Twitter account called Young Jerry's, which is really, really great.
One other thing about the Geriatric for Juniors conference is they do have a poster competition as well. Yes. So if anyone's done any projects and that they want to present somewhere, they can submit them to that.
And my thing this week is, I've got one of two, what should we go with? I'll go with NHS Improvement, and they produced a really nice looking confusion care pathway. Focusing on the multidisciplinary team management of older people with confusion. And I'll put the link for that in the show notes because it's really nice, nice and colourful, nice and simple, and just really goes through the core bits about managing a confusion in an acute hospital.
Okay, so as ever, we're going to start with a definition. We thought we wouldn't define sex. Most of you probably know what that is, and there are plenty of websites to help if you don't. Instead, we thought we would talk about where sex fits in a kind of hierarchy of needs. So kind of looking at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which kind of says that you may have seen this as a kind of triangle. At the bottom, it's got physiological needs. So everybody needs to breathe, have access to food and water, sex, sleep and homeostasis and excretion. And then moving up the levels, the next level up is safety. And the next one above that is love and belonging. And in there it has friendship, family, sexual intimacy as well. Then the levels above that are esteem and then self-actualisation.
And for an educational podcast, I think that is the first time we've mentioned Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which I think deserves some form of congratulation.
So in this episode, we're really going to discuss the factors that influence the maintenance of this in later life.
Yeah. So let's kick off with a study, a quite large-scale study conducted by the AARP of 1,670 adults over the age of 45.
So not particularly
we'll
what we
come back
would.
To that in a bit, yeah. And they tried to define what a happy sexual relationship looks like. And for those people in their study that were most satisfied, they tended to have a sexual partner, not necessarily a spouse, a frequent sexual intercourse, by which they meant more than once a week, but not necessarily daily, and good health.
And that's in both them
and the partner.
And their partner.
Yeah. And then low levels of stress and an absence of financial worries.
Mm.
Similar sorts of things to what we found when we looked at the well-being episode at the end of the series three.
So that AARP survey actually found that 28% reported having sexual intercourse once a week or more on average in the last 6 months. 40% at least once a month, which is quite a lot. 58% hug or kiss at least once a week. So some form of intimacy. 44% sexual touching or caressing at least once a week. And that was actually increased to 64% if you have a partner. There was also 22% who engaged in masturbation at least once a week, including 25% of those with partners, funnily enough. And 43% were satisfied with their sex lives. They did find that this decreased with age. Other factors they found that affect sexual satisfaction included health, including medications, which we'll touch on later, stress, financial situation, and lifestyle practices such as exercise.
Other key factors that they found affected sexual satisfaction included health status, including medications, that's something we're going to touch on later, stress, financial situation, and lifestyle practices, so things like exercise.
So the Irish Longitudinal Study on Ageing, TILDA, from my hometown of Dublin, carried out a really large survey on 8,000 adults all over the age of 50, so again, not super geriatric necessarily. Of these, there was 59% were found to be sexually active, and of those, 69% was at least once a week or month. And they released these figures on Valentine's Day this year.
Which is quite a nice touch,
isn't it? Yeah.
So there's a large-scale study looking at sexual desire in later life, again, looking at around 1,400 participants, again, with an age range starting at 45, which is really not really what I would call later life. And that's a lot of the problem with any of the studies on sexuality and sexual behaviour, is that they tend to have quite a young focus in their sampling. Mm.
TILDA did have quite a good spread of ages, didn't it? I mean, some of the data that we're going to talk about later brackets them into sort of 60 to 70, 70 to 80, and then 80
and,
plus.
And so TILDA's there are studies out there. It's also a longitudinal study, so there'll be more stuff coming. Yeah.
And the big study in the US, the Lindau et al. Study in 2007, which is from the NSHAP study, that also did it into brackets. So even though it started at 50 or so, you still had them segregated into age. Mm. Although they did cut it off at 85. Yeah.
Okay, so reasons that sexual desire might be reduced in older age can be broken down into three main themes, and most of these we're going to talk about a little bit later. Although the most influential overall, kind of unsurprisingly, was the attitude that person had towards sex as the most important, far more than biomedical factors.
So there, I think broadly we can split the attitudes into three areas. There's the biological, and we're going to talk about that at length in a little bit. The psychological reasons.
Yeah. So some of those things are things like the sexual information that they have available to them, their attitudes towards sexual expression, any mental health conditions that they may have, including depression and or treatment. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later. But some of the other psychological things that probably affecting this quite a lot are kind of a youth orientated culture. So kind of ideas of beauty. There's kind of poor representation of sexual attitudes and expression for older adults as well. It's not so well accepted.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that when reading up on the topic, because even in the media, things like NBC have used phrases such as sexed up seniors, surprisingly frisky was one of the quotes about older people. And even the NHS website had at one point written, birds do it, bees do it, even OAPs do it.
And I think
so there is an attitude out there.
Yeah. And also I think people's attitude towards their self changes. For example, when people have had mastectomies. Gabor, have you seen that when people have had surgery and their perception of their own sexuality has changed?
Certainly. A lot of women do go through major traumas and issues about their body image, not just with mastectomies, but also hysterectomies. They tend to feel that they are no longer a whole person or a whole woman, and therefore that puts them off any sexual activity. Part of the reason may also be that having had surgery, they consider that having sexual activity might be painful or uncomfortable, and it puts them off. There are other issues too with other types of surgery where the body image can be greatly distorted with in such situations where people end up having stomas, for instance.
That's good.
They feel that it gets in the way of intimacy, and they're worried about things like the smell and actually what it looks like.
And you've provided a really nice resource, actually, that we're going to link in the show notes and have on the website for some more information around that, and that you can share with patients as well.
We've had biological, we've had psychological, and then the third section then is social.
It's, yeah, so some things that spring to mind is availability of partner, whether there's someone around, But also looking at, if you do have a partner, the length of the relationship and the quality of that relationship as well.
And there's something about availability of partners, isn't there, that maybe changes when people move location?
Yeah, I think especially with women, because they often... They do live longer than men, yeah. And then they end up being widowed. And I think in some of the studies, that's the main reason cited as not being sexually active is just that they don't have a partner anymore. Mm. Their partner has passed away.
Yeah. And something we're going to talk a little bit more about later is relationships in care homes where partners may be separated, or the facilitation of a normal relationship can be impaired.
Recently, there has been a movement towards getting married couples or couples placed in the same care homes. But even if they're placed together, they may not be in the same room. And even if they're in the same room, they're usually in two single beds, and they're not put in a bed that they may have shared, you know, for the most of their lives together.
Yeah. Many older people have really satisfying sexual lives as they age, because a lot of the distractions that might be there in their younger years have gone. They may have more time, more privacy without children and such like being around, no worries about getting pregnant.
Although we'll come on to why that's not necessarily good cognitive bias to have.
And then perhaps greater intimacy with a partner that you've been with for a longer time.
Yeah. So that's the kind of three broad areas. We're going to kind of go down into a little bit more detail into some of them now. So we're going to start off with biological factors specific to ageing, starting with talking about hormones and the hormone changes that happen. And so, for example, both men and women's sexual desire is primarily driven by hormones. In men, it's androgens such as testosterone, and in women, it tends to be estrogens as well as the androgens, so again, testosterone. In women, there's a drop in both androgens and estrogen by about 50% at the time of menopause. And reduction of these hormones can cause lots of different changes.
This we see quite a lot. One of the main issues is that after the menopause, the vaginal mucosa becomes drier because of the lack of estrogen priming, and that can cause soreness and dryness, and making certainly sexual intercourse very uncomfortable or painful. The other thing is that skin conditions may start developing, in particular the things like lichen sclerosus, which can cause narrowing of the vaginal orifice and, again, making sexual intercourse quite difficult and uncomfortable.
Mm. And the atrophic changes can often be mistaken for recurrent urinary tract infections, can't they, when people have what appears to be a cystitis and frequency and dysuria, may just be atrophy.
It is very, very important if you've got somebody who is presenting with recurrent symptoms of soreness or pain on passing urine, that she is examined to make sure that she hasn't got atrophic vaginitis as the underlying problem. And it's very easy to treat, because one can give estrogen creams, which are very helpful. The other thing that I would say is that because of the soreness and the discomfort in participating in sexual activity, the reduced frequency can also cause a kind of positive feedback, so that the frequency of intercourse becomes less, and that actually aggravates the narrowing and the soreness. Mm. So it's important to try and reverse some of these changes.
And some of the treatments can be the estrogen creams, as you were saying, but also just lubrication as well to kind of help with that dryness.
Yes.
And some of the problems that you can have is that, as you were saying, the pain can be worse, and then if there's atrophic vaginitis, you're more likely to get abrasions and tears, which can then in turn make it more painful, make you more susceptible to infections. And that's something that in ELSA, which is the English equivalent of TILDA, there was a report in 2017, this year, again, released on Valentine's Day, called How Long Will I Love You?, looking at that aspect of ELSA. And they found that 30% of women between 70 and 79 reported vaginal dryness, which is a huge number, so a third of people, and 15% reported vaginal pain. And between 30 and 40% of women in all age brackets over 60 reported usually or always having difficulty with arousal or orgasm.
Yeah, I don't think healthcare professionals really realise how big an issue it is.
No.
And we haven't made that much progress in it either, because if you look at some of the older studies, like there's a study from 1999 by Lauman that has a 43% prevalence of sexual dysfunction in older women. Mm. Then Lindau in 2007, 50% prevalence. So there's no real progress there.
Yeah.
I would add that generally the management of sexual dysfunction in women is very much inferior to that in men.
Mm. Mm.
Sexual dysfunction in men, it seems to be a much easier subject to talk about.
Mm. That could be a whole topic in itself, yeah. Couldn't it? Mm. To talk about.
And the decline in testosterone levels in men actually, perversely, is slower. And from the age of 40 to 70, that it only drops by about 30% versus the 50% we were talking about in women. Often men may have a prolonged time to erection, with around a third of people, again, reporting some degree of erectile dysfunction. And again, data from ELSA, that was most commonly seen in the men over the age of 80, where that occurred 50 to 70% of the time. Mm. Men may also have surgery that affects their sexual function, and a prostatectomy obviously can be curative for treatment for prostate cancer or part of a treatment plan for someone who's got benign prostatic hypertrophy, but it can cause urinary incontinence and erectile dysfunction. And there are medications, as we're alluding to, that people can have to try and reduce the frequency of erectile dysfunction, obviously when used within the sort of the license for the medication.
So moving on slightly, we're going to talk briefly about the influence that chronic disease can have on sexual activity and desire. And there are lots of chronic diseases that all negatively affect sexual desire, things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, arthritis and cancer. And all of these are kind of through different physiological mechanisms, vascular processes, as well as impact on the reproductive structures themselves that limit body function. And there's lots of studies looking at the decline in sexual desire after heart attacks and stroke, but none of them actually really look at pre and post.
No, they do, they're often sort of surveys and things conducted after, and it doesn't give you the before.
Yeah, which I guess makes sense. It'd be quite difficult to predict.
It would.
But still, looking at what the influences were before.
It would be interesting to see if people who have had heart attacks actually did have erectile dysfunction prior to their...
Yes.
As a sign of vascular disease.
Yes.
Yeah. And add that to our little list of potential studies we're generating during this for people to go and do. You have that one for free.
It's quite well recognised that men with diabetes tend to have lower sexual desire compared to other men of the same age without diabetes. Mm. Again, the studies aren't hugely robust, but it's just something to bear in mind when you're seeing people.
There is some evidence that men, particularly with type 2 diabetes, also suffer from coexisting hypogonadism, and there is the recommendation now that new type 2 diabetics are tested for their testosterone level, as not only does it affect their sexual function, but it can also obviously have an adverse effect on their bone health. And there is some evidence too that a low testosterone does have a separate impact on cardiovascular morbidity.
It all kind of feeds in together.
It's part of the metabolic syndrome.
I guess the other thing as well is it's not just the disease in itself, it's also the medications used to treat the disease. So quite a lot of drugs that we give really commonly, like antihypertensives, antihyperglycemic agents, vasodilators, we don't think about telling the patient in advance that this could lead to erectile dysfunction.
And also we know that people with comorbidities are more likely to have low mood and poor mental health. So many different things all feeding in together. The next thing we were going to look at was continence, which we know becomes more of a problem with age.
Yeah, and we've talked about this, the third episode of the first series, want to go all the way back to then, was on continence, particularly urinary incontinence.
Yeah, so that may affect how people see themselves, or might be a worry during having sex that they may be incontinent. That could be because of extra pressure on the belly. during
sex. Like a stress incontinence.
Yeah.
And you can get around that by changing positions so yes. that there's less pressure there.
Yeah. The good news is that usually if you seek help or offer help, that usually it can be managed to prevent that from happening. So that doesn't have to be something that limits people. So next we're going to move on to kind of talks about biological things that might directly affect sexual desire, to conditions and circumstances that might impact or limit it. So things like reduced mobility.
So joint pain from arthritis could make the act of sexual contact uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Common treatments for osteoarthritis may help that, such as exercise, mm-hmm. medications, possibly joint replacement surgery, rest, warm baths, changing the position or the timing of the sexual mm-hmm. activity can be helpful.
And Arthritis UK have produced a leaflet that gives advice about different sexual positions for different joint problems.
Can be particularly important when you've got some degree of joint deformity mm. or lack of mobility in yeah. certain joints like the hip.
Yeah, and after hip operations and things, it's quite clear mm. about what's quite useful.
We'll put
there.
A link to that information sheet in the yeah. show notes as well.
Next, we're going to talk briefly about catheters. So people who have catheters have talked about how their catheter or their disability can affect their sexual self-esteem, feelings of masculinity or femininity, and how the catheter can cause pain or discomfort or unexpected symptoms during sex that might make them a bit nervous about doing that. But lots of people reported that there was a lack of information about the subject and that healthcare professionals, again, were quite reluctant to talk about sex in this context. But there are actually a few good leaflets out there. There's some information on the NHS website, and there's a good leaflet from King's that we're going to put a link to on the show notes, particularly talking about how to have sex with a catheter, how to kind of put a condom on so you can bend the catheter backwards and then put the condom over the top.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of people thought that having a catheter meant that you just couldn't have sex. Even some healthcare professionals think that. Mm. But actually, it is doable.
There is actually very little out there to give advice on that.
Hopefully this leaflet will help. We'll put a link to it from the King's. I remember that being quite useful when I worked there. And that's for patients, so you can share it with them.
Yeah, and often the nurses in those specific areas, like a urology specialist nurse, they can be really useful yeah. and often yeah. know more than a lot of the doctors.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So now I think we should talk a little bit about medications mm. and how medications may affect sexual desire, sexual function.
Mm-hmm.
Mary has touched on that a little bit already. So particularly we're thinking maybe about antidepressants, antihypertensives. They're all known to potentially affect sexual function. Particularly thinking about alpha blockers, diuretics, and your calcium channel blockers. They can all reduce sexual function in men. There's lots of theories why this might also be the case in women, but I think there's much less evidence and much less study gone on there, which I think backs up what we were saying earlier, yeah. Gabor, about there being a paucity of information really for and about women, but quite a lot relatively about men.
But logically, if these medications affect the vascular system and the nervous system, so if it affects men, it would seem logical that it would affect women too.
Yeah.
Psychiatric medication is something particularly to look out for because that they quite commonly can decrease sexual desire, with SSRIs being
SSRIs
the major
the one,
culprit yeah. for that one. Yeah, they can reduce sexual desire, cause erectile dysfunction, and make it much more difficult to achieve orgasm, both through sex and through masturbation. So not really the psychological aspect. It's not necessarily coming into play so much there.
Yeah, and SSRIs are the sort of the first line treatment of choice in most older people for low mood.
Partly because of anxiety as well.
Yeah, because of the low anticholinergic properties.
The other group I would say that might be a problem are the anticholinergics themselves, because they reduce secretions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Good thought, actually. Mm. Yeah, very good point.
The good thing about SSRI sexual dysfunction is that it's quite dose dependent. So if you're well maintained on a slightly higher dose, you might be able to reduce that dose down a little bit, and that might be enough to help that dysfunction and get the right balance. We were talking before about how obviously mood plays such an important influence on sexual desire, that it's quite a fine balance in depression that you may not be motivated to, and then the medication may help you to be motivated again. But then similarly, if you had a fairly high sex drive before and then the SSRIs dampen that down, that may become a really significant side effect for you in the depression. So it's about balancing that for each person.
And I think it's also about knowing that it could be a side effect. Yeah. So if your mood's improved and you want to have more of a sex drive, but then you're having issues with vaginal dryness or something, that knowing that that could be because of it and I can just use a lubricant or something,
yeah,
or is report, also really useful.
Report it to whoever's prescribing it for
yeah.
you. That, that is something you can negotiate.
Some drugs can increase libido.
Yeah,
there's a few, but one of them is dopamine agonists to think about, particularly with the impulse control disorders, which occur, depending on the dopamine agonist, somewhere between sort of 8 or 10, up to 14, 15% of patients. And one manifestation of that can be hypersexuality, more like a compulsive behaviour manifestation, really. And there's quite a lot of case studies on that. And it is something that I think if you're starting people on dopamine agonists for the doctors listening, you do have to warn people about the impulse control disorders.
Thinking about relationships as well, there's pathological jealousy can come as well.
Yeah.
So not just looking at the sexual side of things, but actually that could affect relationships significantly.
And that could be really distressing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that could be part of a dementia or sometimes I see quite often in patients with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about dementia just shortly. Before we get there, we're going to talk about sexually transmitted infections. So this section that we're moving on to next is specific considerations to the current older generation. So we talked earlier about how some people might feel more comfortable with having sex because the risks of pregnancy are no longer there. But that in turn can lead to some risky behaviours because people may not be aware of the risks because they weren't so prevalent when they were young.
What happened in 2008? Anyone know what happened in 2008 to do with HIV?
Well, I heard that in 2008, the prevalence of those diagnosed with HIV or AIDS flipped from being younger adults to those 45 and older.
That's it.
And I don't think many people actually know that.
No. So the current highest rates of diagnoses are in those people over the age of 54. And there's relatively limited research on people diagnosed with sexually transmitted infections in those people over the age of 55.
And 55 is what the infectious disease world kind of cut off as their older adult because they're using sort of world population definitions. So this generation who now don't need to worry about pregnancy, never had sex education before, didn't need to know about all of these things, may be having risky sex without realising it may be risky. And there was a study by Fisher et al. In 2010, looking at condom use in older adults and finding that that is much less. So that included people who are not in monogamous relationships. In those defining themselves as single and dating, 50% of men and 29% of women reported using a condom rarely or not at all.
I assume that's something to do with the fact that there's no longer a risk of pregnancy.
I was just going to say, before we move on from the illness and medication sort of stuff, just that it's not all doom and gloom and that actually better sex is, it's a two-way street. So better health and better sex are related to each other. If you have better health, you're more likely to have better sex. But also if you have more frequent sex, it has been associated with better health in all the, in the Tilda study, in the Lindau study in the States and in ELSA as well.
So has there been much looking at correlation more than
well it's not though, yeah. they don't have causation, but there's an association between better health and people who the people who are having more sex are more healthy. I mean,
more reasons to keep people well and active.
Yeah, keep at it.
So we can talk a little bit about dementia now and dementia and its impact and influence on sexual function and things you need to think about.
So we're going to talk a little bit about relationships. Then we're going to talk a bit about consent and assessing capacity before the final thing we're going to talk about is care home residents.
Yeah. So thinking about relationships, some people with dementia show an increased interest in sex. So in thinking about relationships, some people with dementia show an increased interest in sex and physical closeness as their inhibitions decrease, particularly in things like frontal temporal dementias, whereas sometimes that may go the opposite way as well sometimes. Mm. People with severe dementia may not recognise their partner, but still seek that sexual contact or closeness, perhaps elsewhere. And in latter stages, thinking about people who are caring for their partner, who may be living with dementia, that in itself can be a potential conflict or actually can be sort of physically comforting.
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky area, isn't it?
But that intimacy is something that can that really lasts. And there's lots of examples of people going dancing, for example, and that they are carers for each other or one way, and that there's that kind of loss of relationship or change in your relationship to something else. but that things like music and dancing can actually be something that's very joined, and that intimacy that they had there when they were younger is kind of reignited and they have that kind of space for it.
And the person with dementia in that scenario may not actually be able to verbalise or really articulate that, but that you can sort of tell that it's there, that some of that memory is there.
To keep that closeness.
Yeah. Talk about consent now.
Yeah. So this is quite an interesting area, and actually we had quite a lot of email conversations about this as a faculty. It was really interesting discussions. So kind of what we're doing now is kind of highlighting the summary of that, really, and thanks to Jackie, our social worker, who helped us a lot with this. This is a really potentially quite a tricky area. And there's quite a high risk for older adults with dementia to be vulnerable and to have a need for some safeguarding, but we also really need to make sure that we aren't overly paternalistic and take away their rights. So looking at illegalities, lots of this is to do with case law. So case law seems to recognise that decisions in relation to sexual activity are more visceral than cerebral. Therefore, whilst the ability to use and weigh up information is important, it's not likely to loom so large as it would in other assessments of capacity.
In other differences from the usual Mental Capacity Act process, when someone lacks capacity, another person cannot consent on their behalf, which makes sense when you hear it, but it also is quite new to consider that being a change.
That way.
Yeah, and that fits in with the best interest decision making, that you can't make a best interest decision on this front.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the Mental Capacity Act does not allow for people to make advanced decisions in relation to sexual matters. And that's also an interesting point, because you can't plan ahead and say, I will want to do it or I won't want to do it. You cannot.
Yeah. So when it comes to assessing capacity, this is an area that could be quite difficult because it doesn't obey all of the usual rules that we would stick by. There are some really good resources that we found doing this that we're going to put links to in the show notes. One is a blog called The Small Places, summarising the law around this, and also an information leaflet called The Final Taboo, which we'll put there. And they're really good reading for anyone, particularly working in care homes or in an area where you are responsible or have a duty to people's well-being in older age.
So thinking about capacity and what that looks like and what sort of things you have to think about, the case law for assessing capacity around whether or not someone understands the issues around sex focuses really on three areas. One is the actual mechanism of sex. One is around the risk of sexually transmitted diseases, and in younger people, the risk of pregnancy. And the third is the understanding that someone can refuse. Mm. And I think you need to show understanding in those various domains as part of the capacity assessment process. Mm.
And I think as well, it's really important to assess whether the patient or the person with dementia recognises the person that they will be having that relationship with, and whether they can express their views and their wishes within that relationship, or how they will be affected by rejection as well. And it's important that the sex is sort of mutually pleasurable and enjoyable, and not sort of no hurt involved or any degradation.
Because that must be something that occurs quite commonly as people have worsening dementia, that they don't recognise their spouse.
Or their influences on how their behaviours may affect them.
Yeah.
The Sexual Offences Act 2003 makes it a criminal offence to deliberately target vulnerable people for sexual gain. A vulnerable person might be exploited even when it seems like they're consenting to sexual activity, because if they don't recognise that they're being mistreated or manipulated, they're very vulnerable. So where there are differences between the cognitive abilities of the two people, there is that potential for abuse because of the unequal power dynamic.
So that's one partner who's living with dementia and the other partner who's cognitively intact.
Well, it could be partners, it could be anybody.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where it becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
So that is why it is important to have that framework to look at this in.
And another thing that struck me that would be quite difficult is if two people in a relationship both had cognitive impairment, which can, I think, sometimes be an issue in younger people with learning disabilities and so on, and there's capacity issues there.
Yeah.
But if two older people both have dementia or cognitive impairment and they're, you know, previously married or whatever, you know, that's difficult as well to decide whether...
I think that's where these documents are quite useful in building that framework around it and remembering that there's the visceral component as well as the cognitive, that they don't have to be able to think everything through as long as they're being safe within that framework.
I think the Final Taboo Guide to Dementia, Sexuality in Care Homes, I think, is really good for specifically that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other kind of framework thing to think about is that if you do think that they lack capacity to make a decision about this, that the level of supervision you would have to provide to prevent someone from engaging in sexual activity would potentially amount to a DOLS, so a deprivation of liberty safeguard. So it's really worth thinking about seriously. And that probably explains why we're quite paternalistic around it, that we're really trying to protect people, but inadvertently actually kind of mollycoddling a little bit too much and not allowing that natural process. So finally, we're going to talk about care home residence.
It's part of thinking about sexual needs and sexual desires, and someone living in a care home is part of the holistic care. And there is quite good evidence that residents would welcome such discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a systematic review in 2015. It just looked at nursing home residents and their perspectives and attitudes, and found overall the majority had a positive attitude towards age, sexuality and sexuality in care homes.
And there was another study by Bauer et al. That showed that while care home staff agreed that addressing sexual issues should be part of holistic care and that residents would welcome these discussions, it's often not addressed. And the other thing they raised there, which is really important, is that there's quite often an assumption of heterosexuality as the norm in care home settings, and not addressing that and finding out. And especially in a cohort of patients who may never have been able to express that clearly or share that, it's something to really bear in mind. I think younger generations, as they kind of cohort through, that'll be a much more open process.
Baby boomers are coming through. But I did read that it's supposed to be approximately 4 million older LGBT adults by 2030 in the United States. So that is a huge number of older adults that will need their cares attended to, needs attended to, I should say.
So I think overall, I think what we've seen is that the biggest problem with older people and sex is talking about it.
Yes.
And part of the point of making this podcast is to encourage people to think about it and talk about it
with the people
that they're looking after and working with.
And we found some really nice resources. So do go to the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk. For each episode, we have a separate page with the show notes, links to all the articles that we're talking about and these resources as well. And a really interesting read, I would suggest.
And if there are resources that we've not found, please leave a comment underneath.
Let us know.
And we can put them onto the website.
And just remember that regular sexual activity in older age is a normal finding. And despite sexual dysfunction, it can be normal and can be facilitated.
So if you've got any comments, please do let us know. We're on Twitter at MDT_podcast.
We're on facebook.com/MDT podcast.
And our website again is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk.
And remember, next week we will be having a journal club on Twitter using the hashtag MDTClub to discuss the issues that have been raised in this. And that's going to be at 8:30 UK time.
The MDT Podcast.
And now it's time for the MD Teaser. This is our cunningly titled MDT item guessing game. So we have a couple of guests here today who can take part. So just to clarify the rules, Joe, because you never seem to quite know the rules.
Yes.
It's the person that
so rude
makes the other person guess the thing quickest.
Yes.
Okay, good. So you're going for the shortest time.
Yes.
Yeah. Lovely, good.
I generally do.
Good.
All right. You go first.
Who should go first?
I think ladies first.
Yeah, we're understudied.
Oh,
come on.
You were going to say that.
All right.
Do I need to time you yet?
Yeah. So tell me when I can start.
Ready? Go.
This is an action that is mandatory and it is assessed regularly by audits on the ward. It involves a liquid that runs out of taps and it is something that everyone has to do.
Washing?
Hand washing.
Hand washing?
Yes. How long?
20 seconds.
Okay. All right.
Reset?
Yep.
Yeah.
Ready? Go.
So this is a group of people that work both in the community and on our hospital wards. They work as part of the team.
OT,
no,
social worker.
You're very similar to them. They're more focused on movement.
Physiotherapist.
Yay.
That was 15.
Yay.
Sorry,
Joe.
You've got Mary to help. Come on.
And now we've got one for you. And we're going to hand over to Tappy, who will give you the clue.
Yes.
Here's a little bit more of the MD Teaser sound. Keep guessing.
You know what that sound is? Drop us a line. Use the hashtag MD Teaser.
Yes.
You can contact us through Twitter at MDT_podcast.
on facebook.com/MDT podcast.
If you want to be quiet about it, go to the website, and it's www.hearingaidpodcast.org.uk, and at the top right, head for Contact Us.
And follow at Young Jerry's.
And that wraps up this week's episode of the MDT podcast.
MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a Hearing Aid Podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.